Let's push forward into another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening to the book of Matthew, chapter number 5, where we will begin with verse 27 in just one moment. This section is what is referred to widely as the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus gave this address, which actually includes some interaction with people in the crowd, as we will discover later, at the beginning of his second year of ministry, while he was seated on the southern slope of a hill rising up from the north coast of the Sea of Galilee, a hill that rises above Capernaum and Bethsaida, Galilee. All of this is within just a few miles of each other. Jesus had gone up and prayed all night at the top of this hill, and in the morning, he called for his larger group of disciples and designated out of them 12 men to become his apostles, those that will be involved in the establishment of the church later. They don't understand that as being the case. Right now, they just consider themselves to be the top echelon of the coming kingdom of the Messiah. And Jesus is, of course, that Messiah. After he designates the 12, he comes down to a little level spot on the side of the hill, which I think is just partway down toward the seashore. And there he sits down and begins to teach, as he's been doing already, to large crowds of people. He begins with his Beatitudes, which is an attitude adjustment, if you will. He wants the people to understand that bad situations now, bad circumstances now, should not change the need all of us have for a good relationship with God and with each other. And so we should consider ourselves blessed by God when we're in right relationship with God and with other people. Now, after he finishes with the Beatitudes and warns people that will live up to this standard that he's giving them, that they're going to get bad reaction to that. And they should just count that as a joyful thing, because that's the way righteous people in the past have been treated. Then he gives what I consider to be the core thematic part of this whole sermon. And that is, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, who were considered to be the religious conservatives, the exemplary people in Jewish religious society. Jesus says, unless you do a better job at true faithful relationship than they have, you will not enter into the kingdom of heaven, or to the kingdom of God, the messianic eternal kingdom. He then proceeds to give them examples of this. And the examples take this form almost always. You have heard that it was said of old. And then he launches into something from the Old Testament writings, but always something that the Pharisees have been teaching about, and they've given their own little twist to it. One of those was the Pharisees believed it was perfectly appropriate to have very angry attitudes toward people that you didn't like. But Jesus' response was, no, if you are so angry you call people nasty names and wish bad things for them, that's the same as killing them, because you're committing basically character assassination, and that's not appropriate. God's point in telling people do no murder was to show respect for people like you, like me, who have been made in the image and likeness of God. So respect across the board is what's expected from believers. Verse 27 of Matthew 5, Jesus gets into the next topic that he wants to use as an illustration. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Now that comes straight out of the Ten Commandments, one of the first things God gave to the Israelis as they were coming out of Egypt. And it's very simple on its face. That is, when you marry someone, you're in it for the long haul. You don't cheat on them. You don't have relationships with other people that would intrude on that relationship. Unfortunately, in this first century time period, the Pharisees, for their own selfish purposes, I think, had liberalized the religious attitude toward divorce and therefore basically allowed for serial adultery by legal means. And this is what I mean by that. There were two schools of thought amongst the Pharisees. The minority position was that when God gave directions regarding divorce, this is from Deuteronomy 24. Let me read it to you from our English Standard Version we've been using. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he's found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her from his house, and she departs from her house or his house, and then it goes on to the next topic that's related to this issue. But the Pharisees, over the couple of centuries they've been in existence, have looked at this, and they saw the word "found some indecency in her" as anything goes. The common silly application is, if she burns your breakfast, you can divorce her because you found some indecency in her. And so that's the minority viewpoint was, no, that is too liberal an interpretation. It's talking about something seriously wrong with the spouse. That's the reason for divorce. But the majority of viewpoint, and the viewpoint that the Pharisees, the apostles would have been quite familiar with, and even, dare I say it, comfortable with, was a very liberal take that all wives could be divorced for any reason whatsoever. And so Jesus addresses that as he deals with the topic of adultery. So he says, you've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I'm going to tell you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So Jesus says the problem is lustful thinking. It's wanting more relationships, sexual relationships open to you than what you're supposed to be having. It's supposed to be one man, one woman together for a lifetime. And originally, that lifetime was for eternity. You know, Adam and Eve were married for eternity. But then sin came into the world and screwed things up. So Jesus says, if you guys, because it's mostly going to be men that he's addressing in this crowd, if you guys look at another woman that is not your wife and you think in your head all about having sex with her, that is adulterous. You are not supposed to be having those sorts of thoughts go through your head. Now, we need to make a distinction here that I think Martin Luther addressed when he was talking about this topic. We're not talking about fleeting thoughts, little physical reactions that men and women can have in day-by-day interactions with people of the opposite gender. Martin Luther said this. He says, you can't stop the birds from flying over your head, but you don't have to let them nest in your beard. And he was applying it to this idea that, yes, it's likely that you're going to have some fleeting thoughts go through your head in your day-to-day interactions with people, but you don't have to keep dwelling on them and give them room in your heart. And so that's what Jesus is talking about here. You play around with that thinking process, you've got a problem. You got a problem with your relationship with God. This is the reason why pornography is such a dangerous aspect of our modern day society. It's been a problem in the past already. But now with modern technology, it is so readily available. It gives too many opportunities for people to be caught up in this adultery of the heart situation. Let's stress it again. The original intent of God is one man, woman, one woman together for a lifetime. No wanting any other relationships. No thinking about other relationships. No divorcing them so that you can move on to another relationship. Verse 29 of our Matthew 5 account. Jesus continues, if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out. Throw it away. It's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. This is what we call hyperbole here. Jesus is not directing that when you have some sort of temptation of the eye, that you just rip it out by the roots. No, that would be the extreme solution. The better solution is quit looking where you shouldn't be looking. Quit thinking about things you shouldn't be thinking about. Remove yourself from the temptation situation. This is where accountability partners can be very helpful. When we know that we've got certain temptations, and it might be other temptations than this, when we know we have certain temptations, we stay out of the places where that temptation is strong. We stay away from those people that cause that temptation to be strong. And we call up our helpers to encourage us to stay strong in these times of temptation. Verse 30, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than for the whole body to go into hell. Again, another reason why we know this is hyperbole is in the resurrection, in the transformation, we all get our brand new bodies. Any type of loss of limb that happened in this physical life, that's going to be reversed in the eternal body. So Jesus is just trying to get the folks listening to him to understand how serious temptations are, and especially temptations of a sexual nature. Paul writes about the fact other temptations take place outside the body, but sexual immorality is one that's like right there in the core of us. Now, still on the topic, though, of relationship between husbands and wives. Jesus says, verse 31, it was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. That's the passage I was just reading to you a moment ago from Deuteronomy chapter 24. Verse 32, I say to you, everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery or adulterates her. So Jesus takes the hardline approach to this, that in Deuteronomy 24, where it says indecency there, it has something to do with sexual immorality. Divorce was what happened other than being caught in the act of adultery. Maybe we need to clarify that. By Old Testament law, when someone was actually physically caught cheating on their spouse, they were executed. So there was no divorce. There was an execution. So what Jesus is referring to is apparently not catching them in the act of adultery, but somehow evidence pops up that there was some sort of affair that was going on. And so in that instance, God permitted a divorce decree to be issued by the offended partner. And Jesus says that does have relevance. it is permitted. Now, when we get into the New Testament, Paul also tackles this issue, and he talks about even allowing divorce in the case where the other partner doesn't want to stick around. You can't force someone to stay in the marriage with you. And so Paul allowed for that condition as well. I would also say we would need to talk very seriously about marriages where people are being abused. We need to have an authoritative third party step in and deal with that sort of stuff, because that is criminal behavior and dangerous. If a woman and her children as well need to be protected from that environment by being separated from that abusive person, so be it. We know that God's intent for marriage was for one man and one woman to be together as perfect partners for a lifetime, on the same page, living by the same standards. And when that can't be the case, then yeah, unfortunately, divorce sometimes does occur. Now, back into our text, it says, whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So the idea is that once a marriage is broken up because of adultery, then that has long-ranging implications or impacts. It even affects future relationships. And so Jesus touches on all of those things here. And again, the emphasis is on the idea of relationship. God does not want divorce to come into the picture. It comes by sin because of bad choices. And sometimes a protection for the person who's been sinned against. But that was never God's plan. In later passages, Jesus will tell the Pharisees this, that this was not God's intention from the beginning, because his original intention was one man together with one woman for a lifetime. On to the next example that Jesus uses, verse 33 of Matthew 5. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to he who is, it's the divine name that's indicated here, what you have sworn. So in the Old Testament, you have in the Ten Commandments, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, which is a reference to making an oath in the name of he who is. And there are lots of other passages related to that idea that when you offer testimony and you give an oath, you have to follow through with your oath because it was made in the name of he who is. And so Jesus starts at that point, but he is aware that the Pharisees have been fiddle-faddling around with that original intent again. So that the Pharisees have been doing that stupid, immature game that a lot of us engaged in when we were younger, that you can protect yourself from such promises by allowing an exception that maybe the other person's not aware of. Let me illustrate. Those of you that are old enough, remember back when we were kids, somebody would say, do you promise? And you'd say, I promise. Will you cross your heart? Yes, I cross my heart and hope to die. And then you break it. But then you excuse yourself by saying, but I had my fingers crossed. So the moment you crossed your fingers, everything that you said was negated. And then people would start checking your fingers. And then you later say, but I had my toes crossed. and then they'd even check your toes. I had my shoelaces crossed. You see, the problem here was not the oath. It was the fact that you never had an intention of keeping the oath because you already made for yourself exceptions. And so Jesus is aware that the Pharisees are engaging into that very moronic sort of wordplay. And he says, verse 34, "But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for that's the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king." And so he gives examples of where certain oaths were formulated that mentioned God's throne. "I swear to you by the throne of God," or "I swear to you by the earth," or "I swear to you by this holy city of Jerusalem," "I swear to you by David's city," you know, things like that, that what I'm telling you is true. And Jesus says, don't do that. Don't engage in this wordplay. Verse 36, "Do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black." And we're not talking about dying. He's talking about actually, physically, just by thinking about it, changing one of your hairs from one color to another. We can't do that. We don't have that control. So why swear by the hairs of your head? Which apparently they did. Verse 37, "Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil or from the evil one or from evil intent, perhaps." You get the understanding here. This is where the book of James picks up on the same thing. James, being the half-brother of Jesus, says pretty much the same thing, that you need to let your yes mean yes all the time and let your no mean no all the time. Everyone should be able to trust your word. And you might have to say maybe every once in a while, or we will see, but the moment you say yes or no, that's the way it should be. And this is the reason why in early American history, you had some Christian groups, Quakers prominent among them, that would not take oaths. You know, "I swear by God," or "I swear on the Bible that I will tell the truth," or "I will do this," or "I will do that." Instead, they would affirm it as yes or no. And so what is written into our early American history legal documents is an allowance for affirmation rather than oath-taking. When you go into the court of law, when you go into the military, the same thing exists. I know because the first time I went to the military straight out of high school, I took the normal standard oath. "I swear to do this, that, and the other thing. So help me God." The second time I went back in the military, I had been studying this passage and had decided that really affirmation should be the better choice for a Christian. Let your yes mean yes and your no mean no. So the second time I went back in, I simply affirmed, "Yes, I will do all of these things that I'm saying I will do today." And I encourage Christians to take that sort of stand, since it's right here in Matthew 5. It's also in the book of James, and it seems to be the standard practice. But I do know there is a Christian teaching that goes all the way back to first century that Jesus' main point here was to make sure you always kept your word. And so some Christian groups still allowed people to swear by the name of God provided you kept your word. I can't quite come to that conclusion myself from Scripture, but I will certainly understand if you would agree with some of those that come from that. But all things being equal, Christians need to tell the truth. They need to mean what they say and don't try to manipulate and monkey with the language. Be open and honest and be a keeper of your word, because anything other than that is evil. It is wrong. It is sinful. Because God is a keeper of his word, we need to be keepers of our words. Matthew chapter 5, verse 38 is our next example. We'll just barely introduce it. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This is cited from Exodus 21, Leviticus 24. I think there's another passage. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, Deuteronomy 19 mentions it as well. This is called the Lex Talentis, and it is misunderstood what Jesus is about to engage here way too often. The Lex Talentis was a guide given to judges that if somebody broke your arm, then the judge could, in fact, order that your arm be broken as well, that the perpetrator's arm be broken as well. This was not a matter of personal retaliation. You couldn't just simply break somebody else's arm because they broke yours. The court actually is the one that invoked this rule. So Jesus, though, is dealing with Pharisees who use this as an excuse for retaliation. And Jesus will teach us very clearly, there's never an excuse for personal retaliation.